Why would you say private money lending is a great business right now?
First lien position, lender, least risk. Second lien position, next set of risk. Third lien position, next set of risk. Highest risk is the actual borrower. Because if there's nothing left, they don't get paid anything. So they're putting forth all the effort and energy, and they get to keep what's left over on the end. And I have never seen a rehab project come in on timeline and under budget.
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth. We have an excellent episode ahead with two remarkable guests joining us today, Eric Fuller and Logan Bowers, co-founders of Congregation Capital. Eric is a dedicated husband and a father of three, currently leading a hybrid life split between Brazil and the United States. Eric's journey is as diverse as it is inspiring, with a background in engineering, including a PhD in biomedical engineering and a growing portfolio in real estate that he's been nurturing since 2016. He's actively involved in various aspects of real estate, from short-term lending ventures like Gator Loans and gap funding for flips to longer-term strategies involving creative acquisition. Our second guest and Eric's partner, Logan, hails from the heart of South Louisiana and is a devoted Christ follower, husband, and a father of three children. Logan's real estate journey began in 2016 as well, and he played a pivotal role in numerous transactions, amassing an impressive portfolio valued at over $10 million, comprising of 145 doors. His ambitions in the real estate world are boundless, with plans to expand to 1,000 doors and build a lending business overseeing private money loans exceeding $10 million. Eric, Logan, we're thrilled to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to be on.
First question, I guess I'll direct to you, Eric. What inspired you to venture into private money lending for real estate?
That's a great question. So when I did several short-term rentals, and I really liked the cash flow that I was getting from them, but it was also extremely hands-on, lots of work furnishing, decorating, prepping, getting it going. And with my family needs to be able to be with the family more and to be able to travel more, I wanted something where I could make money without having to be in person so much. And I saw that Pace was offering Gator Lending as one of the options. And I said, yeah, that looks like something I could do from online without having to be too hands-on on the site wherever I was. And that seemed like a good option to explore. So I got into it. And after a couple of successful deals, I did more and more, met up with Logan, and we got some synergy going. So it's something where you're able to do it from anywhere and you can lend on anything. So it's a very flexible option.
So Logan, on a recent Google Meet, you talked about that unique transition from philosophy and thought from doing the buy and holds real estate investing to this private money lending. Can you talk a little bit about how did you navigate that transition from those types of ventures to private money lending?
Yeah, for sure. So traditionally, I've been super, super involved in my real estate deals, very, very active investor for really since I started in 2016. I was flipping houses. I was managing the contractors, finding the deals, got licensed as the agent, selling them. So I was very involved in the transactions, and I borrowed a bunch of money over that time period, you know, millions of dollars over, you know, several years of doing transactions. And I realized that when I joined Sub 2, that there's this whole world of people that need money. And I was just in a place where I had a bunch of access to money from a bunch of deals that I had done and just a bunch of relationships that I had. And so making that shift was like, it was kind of like an aha moment of like, wow, there's a bunch of people who were in the spot that I was in. I know all of the pieces of the transaction. I know, you know, every bit of it. So why don't I provide a service that people obviously need? Because a lot of people think that it's hard to raise money, and it's always been very easy for me. And I don't really know what that X factor is that makes it so easy to raise the money, but I've never had trouble with it. So that's kind of the light bulb I had of like, man, I can provide a service. And like Eric said, I can do it from anywhere. I can be on vacation with my family. I can be on the beach, can be in the mountains. as long as I have my phone and access to the internet, I can vet and loan deals.
One of the common questions that I get when I'm talking with people about maybe thinking outside of the box and using private money for their deals to get a little bit more creative in how they're acquiring their deals. One of the common questions that I get is, what's the difference between private money lending and then a hard money lender? And, can a private money lender also be a hard money lender? Maybe you could kind of dive into that real quick and just help people understand those differences.
Yeah. So it's kind of nuanced and it's kind of not, right? If you're not familiar with lending, you're like, this sounds like the same thing. The thing that they have in common is they're both going to be higher interest rates than a traditional bank, right? So this money is going to be more expensive because it's more based on the collateral and less on the borrower. But the real distinction between hard money and private money is hard money is basically like going to a bank or a lending institution. These are typically hedge funds, or they're backed by these massive piles of money. And they're going to have a very similar process and underwriting criteria as a bank. They're just going to loan a lower loan to value and charge you a higher rate. Private money is something that you're doing based off a relationship. Everyone that we're doing deals with, the other people that we're partnering with, our capital partners, our money, like this is our money going into deals. This is not a hedge fund. This is not a pool of money. This is actual people that we have relationships with. So private money is relationship based. Hard money is more numbers driven and typically backed by some big institutional money that's just trickling down into the smaller real estate world.
Eric, maybe you could explain this one. Could you just explain the concept of short-term PML and then how that could empower an investor to basically become the cash investor, the cash buyer?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to explain that. So we can do lots of different forms of short-term PML. Some of them are what we call bridge loans, where somebody needs to acquire a property and they don't have the cash to acquire it. So let's say they need $400,000 to buy a property. Maybe it's worth $700,000. It's a great deal and the seller will give it to them very, very cheaply, but the seller needs them to close quickly, right? The seller doesn't say, oh, I can't wait a month and a half. I can't wait 2 months for you to go through the whole bank loan process. I need the money now if I'm going to sell it to you for a really good deal. So we can give them the cash to purchase it. And then over the period of 1, 2, 3 months, they will refinance it into long-term debt. And that's how we exit our bridge loan, either refinance or they just sell the asset. So the bridge loans are very common and we love those. Other forms of short-term lending are gap loans. So somebody already has a loan, a hard money loan, or another, maybe a private money loan on a property, and they just need a little bit more money to either close the loan, or in some cases, some people are partway through a rehab and there's a lot of equity. You know, maybe they're all in, they owe $250,000 for a certain property, but it's going to sell for $400,000. But they're just short, you know, they need 40K more in rehab or whatever it is, and they just ran out of that money. We can give them that last little bit for them to finish the rehab. And then when they sell it, they give us the money back. So those are forms of gap lending. In either way, if you have an incredible deal where you're getting something at a very, very good value, whether you need to fix it or whether it's already good, you should never say no to that deal just because you don't have the money to do it. So an example in Iowa that I did is there was a guy, I'll change his name, call it John. There was a house that was worth $100,000 and it was already rehabbed, already had a tenant in it. It was a good property, but the seller was distressed. So the seller needed money quick in their pocket, even though the property was good. And the seller told John, if you can buy this for me in 5 days, then I'll let it go for $60,000. So John came to me and said, hey, Eric, I really want to buy this property, but I don't have $60,000 and I don't have even a hard money lender or a bank or anybody that can close for me in 5 days. So can you help me buy this property for $60,000? And then in a month, or if we need to extend to 2 months, I'll have you refinanced. So that's what we did. We got a bridge loan that we made good money on. And besides that, John got a really, really good deal too, because even though our bridge loan was a lot more expensive than what a bank would charge, he was able to have that property for way, way less than its true value. And that's how he became a cash investor. So, like, you know, if you see something that's worth $100,000 and it's for sale for $60,000, that's obviously an incredible deal. What if he could buy it for $70,000? That's still an incredible deal. That's 30% off on your real estate, right? So anybody can become a cash investor if they find a good deal and then they just partner with us. You know, the price tag goes up slightly, but that's what we're doing. We're buying them time to be able to resell it or refinance into better debt.
Love it. What strategies or methods do you recommend for PMLs who are looking to find lucrative short-term PML opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's lots of sensationalism around the these short-term lucrative deals, and the truth is that, you know, EMD loans are going to provide the biggest bang for your buck, if you will. The problem is like, if you want to invest any kind of volume of money, you're not going to get those 50, 60, 100% returns in, you know, 30 or 45 days. Those do exist, but to do that at a large scale, it's just too cumbersome of a process to vet that many deals and get those higher returns. Those really, really like extreme returns, right? We're talking about, hey, I'm going to give you, you know, $5,000 and you're going to give me back $7,500 in 30 days. Those exist, right? But, you know, if you have $400,000 to invest, it's hard to find enough of those deals to keep your money working. So then when you have what we call in the, you know, the stock world, you know, the mutual fund guys call it cash drag, right? You have cash drag where you have cash sitting in your account, not doing anything, waiting for an opportunity for these really, really high returns. So first thing I would say, Justin, is for them to be like, just be realistic about what kind of annualized returns you're looking for and have some kind of target for that. And that'll help you select opportunities. But those EMD deals are going to provide the highest amount of return immediately. And then secondly, almost any kind of short-term second lien position deal is going to provide a very high return. But again, you, at that point, we really have to analyze the risk versus the return, because, you know, those second lien positions are just that. You're behind a first lien position that you can force the foreclosure in second lien position. But if you don't buy it conservatively enough, when it goes to sale, when it goes to auction, you may not get all of your money back out, which is the worst case scenario when you're in a lending situation.
What steps do you typically take to fully vet a lending deal, make sure that it meets the standard?
Yeah, so this is half art and half science, right? So we apply some you know, basic metrics of, you know, loan to value. One of the greatest assets you have, though, is for you to feel comfortable with the collateral value. Because at the end of the day, this is a heavily based on the collateral. We do look at borrower credit. We do look at, you know, some of their background check. And like, we do look at the borrowers, and just even you get a lot of information just in having conversations with them. So I have found, and I think Eric would agree, that just getting on a Zoom call where you can see their mannerisms, you can see their face, you can see how they're responding, what their attitude and tone is going to tell you a lot, which is not really quantifiable, but it's important to get that. But you have to be confident in the collateral value. I'll give you an example. We had a deal a few weeks ago that we were looking at. It was a big loan. $1.1 million is what they were looking for. And we were like, hey, we don't think this thing is worth $1.1 million. The borrower was thinking that the property was worth a lot more than that, you know, somewhere in the 1.5 to 1.6 range. I underwrote it and I was like, man, this thing is probably worth $950 is what I think it's worth. So we were like, hey, let's get a third party appraisal to help us guide us through this. Well, the third party appraisal comes back at $2 million, right? So we're in this really awkward position now, right? Of like, hey, we went through this process. They paid for the appraisal. It came in way higher than anything that was realistic, anything in the realm of like possibility. We even had the end lender that was going to do the refinance on it was like, yeah, we don't really think that value is kind of a stretch. I could see maybe 1.4, 1.5. But at the end of the day, it's not the appraiser's money. It's not the lender's money. Like, this is our money. So we kind of went back to the drawing board and said, hey, look, for us to do this, we're going to need you to put some cash into this deal and make this more secure, because what we perceive the value to be, the comfortability number for us is in the 900 range. So we're going to need you to make up the difference for that deal for us to feel comfortable lending on it. So one of the most important things to do is for you to understand. If you don't understand, partner with somebody, bring somebody in, connect with somebody. I love doing this. That's kind of my thing, is like vetting the collateral. Like, I really enjoy that piece because I've just seen so many deals as an agent, as an investor. I've participated in a bunch, but I've also looked at hundreds and hundreds of transactions. So I get to see a lot of opportunities, and I have. So that piece is the piece that I would say is probably the most important, that you, when you're placing your money into an opportunity, is like, you need to be comfortable with that collateral value. And then you need to have that buffer from what you think it's worth, not what the appraiser or the realtor or anybody else says, definitely not what the borrower says, right? Because their value is going to be the highest out of everyone's, right? Is you got to be comfortable with that. And then you got to give yourself some margin in that deal, where if something goes south, you know, you can get out of it safely. So those are the two main things I would say, is be comfortable with the collateral and loan at a safe loan to value, which we don't like to do anything above 70%, but trust your gut. Like, there's sometimes me and Eric are having conversations and I'm like, hey, like, something's off. It doesn't feel right. And that's enough to say no. The hard part is when you're just getting started in this, you don't know if that's nerves or a red flag. It can be really hard to decipher. So it's good to have other people's opinion to help ask you some clarifying questions. Sometimes that may be people that you're partnering with on the deal, or in this case, me and Eric have each other, right? But sometimes we can go bring it to one of our investors that do a lot of deals with us and say, hey, what do you think about this? And they'll give us really good feedback, or they'll ask us some clarifying questions, and we realize we don't have all the answers, and we go back to the borrower and ask some follow-up questions that leads to clarity to say we should do this or we shouldn't. That was a very long answer, but I hope that was helpful.
No, that was good. And I totally agree with what you said about trust your gut. Eric gave me the same advice, and he actually walked me through the first deal that was proposed to me to potentially lend on. The numbers looked decent, but there were some elements of the deal that perked Eric's attention and didn't make sense. And at the end of the day, I didn't end up feeling comfortable after talking with the borrowers a couple of times. I didn't feel comfortable. And turns out I backed out before we even got to a background check. But the connector ended up doing a background check and found that the guy was actually accused of loan fraud back in 2009. So trust your gut, for sure. Trust your gut.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, some people, when they're first starting to do these loans, if you haven't bought and sold houses before, then you definitely need to partner with someone who understands that. Because the reason, it sounds like, 70% loan to value, like, you know, this house is worth $100,000, you're only lending $70,000 on it. Why just 70%? There's a ton of spread there. But they might not realize that when you sell the house, you know, you've got the commissions, you've got the other closing costs. We want to sell it fast. We don't want to let it sit on the market for a long time. So we're going to lower the price as much as we can to get somebody to just buy it quickly, hopefully just buying it cash from us without even having to go through a loan. So that's one of the biggest parameters, is loan to value. You know, especially with gap lending and second position, some people are like, you know, you should gap loan up to 85 or 90%. But that's way too risky, because if that thing goes south, then, and it has to be sold quickly, it's going to be very hard for you to get that money back. And beyond that, there's a couple of things you'll pick up along the way about the states. You know, the United States of America, wonderful, but each state has their own laws. So a deal that you do in Florida, and however it worked, could be completely different than Georgia, and definitely way different than notorious states like California and New York that all have completely different foreclosure laws. In some states, if your borrower just ghosts you completely, or maybe they passed away, maybe something tragic happens, you don't know. But in some states, if you're left holding the bag, right, if the borrower can't pay you back and you've got to take over the property, it's a 1 month process, or even with the right mechanisms, even faster. But in other states, it could be months and months held up in court, a year or two to get your money back. So it's something to be careful on for sure. I was talking with a wealthy real estate investor who has had a very long and successful career. He said, "Eric, everyone I know who's done second position loans has made a fortune and then lost all of it." And so I asked him, like, "Well, how did they lose all of it? What happened? Tell me about it." And it was on these type of loans where they didn't do as much underwriting as Logan and I do. So they didn't understand the foreclosure process. They loaned on lots of homes that they didn't have a good loan to value, and they couldn't get their money back because it was stuck in the foreclosure courts for forever. And they ended up losing a ton of money that way. So you definitely need to be careful about it. I'm not saying that we won't do second position loans, because we definitely do that, but it has to be done extremely carefully.
I see a lot of connector deals where the security for the lender is a JV agreement, a deed of trust, and a promissory note. And that's sort of it, without a lot of additional conversation. What methods do you use to secure your capital in the loan?
Yeah, we're going to use all those same things to secure the loan. So the real documents that have the teeth are the deed of trust and the, some states call a mortgage, right? Deed of trust or mortgage, and the promissory note. Those are the ones that bite, right? The JV agreement, yes, holds weight, but the ones that are recorded and attached to the property are the ones that have the most teeth. So those documents need to be drafted properly. We use attorneys to draft those in whatever state we're doing the loan. So we don't take on the responsibility to do that. We're having an attorney draft it. We're using the JV agreement kind of as more layman's terms and giving that to the attorney and say, "Hey, this is what we need these legal documents to state," right? And if there's not enough collateral inside of the deal, sometimes we'll add additional collateral documents on top of that. So we'll go and cross collateralize properties and saying, "Hey, maybe it is at, 80% loan the value on this property, but we'll go get equity from another property and put a mortgage or deed of trust and promissory note on that property as well to make our overall loan to value lower." Those are the main documents that you need. Again, we talked about the background check, and we're doing the credit pull. There's actually a really cool program that Melissa Palmer is working on, where she's doing a much more in-depth dive in into some of their history and financials, and just it's a very, very comprehensive report. So we're in the process of working with her and kind of making that a part of our process and see if we can streamline some of this, history of the borrower. But those are the real important legal documents that you need. Again, we look at a lot of other stuff. What is their experience? Do they have evidence of that? This seems so simple. This kind of goes back to vetting a deal. It was like, when a borrower submits a bunch of sloppy documents, it immediately makes me think that they don't have their ducks in a row. So they fill out half of the questionnaire. They leave some things blank. They don't upload sufficient documents. All of those things are this is a flag for me, because if you're going to be this sloppy on the front end when you're asking for the money, how much sloppy are you going to be on the back end whenever you're scrapping to try to pay it back because you didn't underwrite this deal well. So though some of those things too are just, that's not really answering your question about loan security, but just one of the things that we look for is when somebody submits all their documents really cleanly, they respond really quickly. We're working with a borrower right now and she's a dream. She's on the ball every day. She gets us what we need super quickly. She's like, "Hey, what's the next step?" She's asking us what the next step is, and she's on the ball. That is what you want to see from a borrower. Every time we ask for something, it's not "Well, I'm going to get it, maybe." She's like, I'll get it done. I'll have it to you by this time. And then she does. Like that is, those are things that we're looking for in a transaction because again, this is a people business. Yeah, we're collateralizing an asset and that is incredibly important, but also you're loaning to a person. Like when deals go south, the quality of the person is going to determine the outcome, right? Not the collateral, because the collateral is only coming into play if the quality of the person is poor.
Yep, definitely. And I'll add to that. I think that there's five key documents that I would talk about for just the property itself, not talking about the borrower. And each of these documents comes about from asking a what if question, right? So how could I possibly lose my money in this deal? What if this happens? What if that happens? So the security deed or the deed of trust, that's what puts the lien on the property. So the question is, what if they tried to sell it and not pay me off? Well, they can't do that if you've got a properly recorded lien and the deed of trust or security deed that says there's a lien. The promissory note. So what if they just give me my money back but don't pay me any interest? The promissory note is what actually states out the terms of how long they have before they can pay you off and when you can foreclose and how much they owe in interest. So that's a promissory note. That's the second one. The third one is the lender's title insurance. And I've been shocked to see on some connectors forms where they have that as even an option. Like, will this have lender's and title insurance? And most of them say yes. Like sometimes a form comes across from a connector that says no. I'm like, no, we're not going to have a lender's title policy. So if there's all these liens from the new roof that got put on 10 years ago and the contractors owed money and, you know, they're going to get paid before we do because we didn't have a title policy. The title policy basically states that if we're in first position or second position or wherever we are, that title company is giving insurance that guarantees that we're right there. There's not going to be other liens that come in front of us. So that's the third one, lender title policy. And then the fourth one that people forget about a lot of the time is just plain old homeowner's insurance, right? And where we can be listed as additional insured. So what if the house catches on fire? What if there's a hailstorm? What if lightning strikes it? And what if it just loses a ton of value? Well, insurance should be paying it off, but how much insurance is on there? What if we're in a second position and they only got it insured up to the first position's value, not up to our additional value? Then the insurance is only going to rebuild that house up to whatever the stated limit was. So we're out of our money then too. And then the fifth document is just the appraisal or the CMA, the inspection, just vetting the actual value of the property. And then like Logan said as well, like making sure that you are actually on board with that value, not just what the appraiser says, because that would answer the what if question of, okay, what if the house is in great shape and the title is clear and everything, and then I get it or I foreclose on it, can I actually get my money back? If you've got those five things, then you should be covered in most scenarios if you've gone a low enough LTV, because they can't sell it without you. They owe you the interest. There can't be any liens in front of you. Any natural hazard would be covered. And there should be value in that house. So the only major risk you've got is the risk that always happens with real estate, which is what if there's a major market crash and the house values just drop down steeply? That's the only thing that we can't really hedge against. Everything else we can prepare against.
Real quick, is a little bit off topic, but I've had the topic of usury laws come up and in relation to sometimes these larger percentage payments back to private money lenders. Have you guys run into anything related to that, or what kind of protects you against that possibility?
Yeah, so the usury laws are not really going to apply, because even though we're mechanically operating like a loan, it's not technically a loan. We are entering into a joint venture agreement where we're providing the capital for a real estate transaction. And the person that is partnering with us is doing the operations of that real estate transaction. So that joint venture agreement lets us operate as joint ventures, and we are partnering together. Those collateral documents are just ensuring that this agreement takes place, right? So from a legal standpoint, right? We're not a lender, we're a partner. That joint venture stand, we are partnering, we are entering into a venture together as partners not borrower lender dynamic.
Can you shed a little bit of light on some of the other investment strategies? Like you had mentioned earlier, EMD for like Gator loans, double closes, and when those might be kind of an advantageous real estate transaction.
Sure. I'll comment on EMD a little bit. So Logan hit the nail on the head when he said they can be great returns, but it's hard to vet them. It's hard to get them going in a good pipeline of them. And there have also been a lot of people who have gone in and out, in and out, in and out, 5, 6, 7 or more times and not made any return. Or maybe just a very, like a 1-2% return that the borrower agreed on because they funded the EMD. And then, you know, the EMD is refundable up through the inspection period, and they just didn't get an end buyer for the deal. So the challenge is, let's assume somebody is a rock star wholesaler and they're doing tons and tons of deals, they're getting tons of money through all this. They generally wouldn't need you to provide that EMD. In some cases, they might if they're short on liquidity for some things, but most of the large wholesale operations that are very successful that I've interacted with haven't needed that. And then most of the new wholesalers have not had enough experience to really know how to lock up the deal properly, how to vet it, how to find a good end buyer. So it's challenging on that end as well. The one thing that I have seen, which would make sense for EMD loans, is there's a wholesaler that's in Gator, and she has been incredibly successful on her own wholesaling before she ever joined Gator. So in her world, she's already connected to end buyers. She already knows how to vet the deals. She can find the new wholesalers who need help with EMD and offer a lot because she can tell them, look, I'll fund your EMD. I'll vet the deal to make sure that it even makes sense. And I'll help find the end buyer. And then you give me a return. She's already got this whole ecosystem set up within wholesaling. So she's got a huge advantage to EMD because EMD is intricately connected to wholesaling. Right. So she's got a really good system there. But if people are completely new to the world of real estate and completely new to wholesaling and new to EMD and they try to start doing EMD, it's definitely possible. But there's just all those challenges.
I think it's one of the riskiest strategies because there's no collateral. You're just operating off of a contract. And so in that, you want to have a mutual release of escrow signed by the seller before you enter into the EMD and you know, fund the money, saying that the seller is already agreeing, because some states you have to have mutual agreement for the EMD to be released. Some states you don't, but the states you have to have mutual EMD to be released, you need that seller to sign off before the EMD is deposited that if you back out during the inspection period, that EMD will be returned. So basically, you just need the buyer side to be signed and then the EMD comes out because we've already got the seller signature up front. That's how you make it safe, but still, it's not secured by anything. So if that, you know, wholesaler fumbles the ball and they get outside the inspection period and then they can't sell it, you lose track of it because you have, you know, 10,000 other things going on. That money could be gone and you lost all the money. So there's nothing securing it there. So that's one of the things that I don't like about it. Some of our favorite short-term deals are like the Morby methods or the double closes, like you said, where these are done based on escrow agreements. So we're wiring money in. It's staying in escrow for usually like a 24-hour period, sometimes, you know, a little bit longer than that, 2 days. And in those, we're wiring the money in. We have an escrow agreement. The title company or the escrow officer is holding the money the entire time. So it never goes to a seller, it never goes to a buyer, it never leaves the escrow account, and it's just there as proof of, in a double close, you know, that the AB transaction can be closed, or in a Morby method, that their down payment is there and available, and then the seller does the carry back right after it closes. And so in both of those scenarios, the money is at title for a short period of time, and then it's returned back to you. So worst case scenario, you spend $25 on a wire and you don't get a return, but you get your money back in 1 day. Best case scenario, you make 1-2% in a day. So those are if we're going to do like the short term, those are definitely more preferred and more secure deals, because your only real risk there is wire fraud or title company fraud, which is very, very, very low opportunity. It is possible, but low opportunity because they have title companies have way too much to lose. And you can get around the wire fraud by just calling and making sure that you confirm the wire instructions before you send the wire. So those are very, very much the most secure deals you're going to do. But you just have to do a lot of them, again, for it to be significant. We can make 1% in a day, and that's a 365% annualized return. But if we only do one of those deals a year, we only made 1% on our money. Not very great, right? So that those are a volume game to better make them worthwhile.
Yep, I agree with that 100%. Double closings are kind of like the golden goose because they're so secure and they can give you that money back quickly. The challenge there is that because they're so secure, there's a lot of people interested in doing them, not just private money lenders, but big institutions. And there's so many of them that, that there's a lot of competition, right? So a lot of people that I talk to that do double closings all the time is like, hey, we could provide the funding. And they say, hey, I've already got my go-to institution. They're giving me a dirt cheap rate. So I'm sticking with them, right? So it's an opportunity where you really got to hunt for them. And if you crack the code on them, then congrats, you found a great way to do it. But they're not easy to find. And when you do find one that's repeat business, you won't be able to charge them a high rate over and over and over again, or at least you probably won't, because they'll be able to find another place that can do them for much less.
Why would you say private money lending is a great business right now?
Yeah, we're in a shifting market, right? Eric was saying earlier, you know, that we can't really protect from a shifting market, but that's why equity in the deals is so important. That loan to value is your protection in the shifting market. I used to flip a lot of houses and I used to make a lot of money flipping houses. And I did it in a down market for the most part in South Louisiana whenever I was doing that. But I was in very affordable price points. So I was very, very strategic about the buyer pool that I was going after. And some of it was just ignorance, honestly. And, you know, I had God's protection and, you know, some ignorance there that was, you know, good. It got me into some deals that I maybe wouldn't do now, but made a lot of money doing it during that time period because we were in the right buyer pools. So as the market shifts and interest rates rise, this is an ideal time to shift your risk from being the person that's taking the risk, because here's the stack of risk. First lien position, lender, lease risk. Second lien position, next set of risk. Third lien position, next set of risk. Highest risk is the actual borrower. Because if there's nothing left, they don't get paid anything. So they're putting forth all the effort and energy, and they get to keep what's left over on the end. And I have never seen a rehab project come in on timeline and under budget. Like, they're always over timeline, they're always over budget. So when we're in a shifting market where values are flattening in some markets, dropping in others, they're still rising in a lot of markets too, but you get to shift that risk and say, hey, I'm gonna take less return. I'm gonna only make $10,000 funding this flip versus making 30 or 40 or 50 if I actually did the flip. But you might only make $10,000 doing the flip too, and you did all of that work. So it's just a great opportunity to take some chips off the table, be a lender, loan some money out while we're in this period where interest rates are literally still rising. You can take advantage of that because money's more expensive everywhere. So you can loan money at a much higher rate than you could 12 or, you know, 24 months ago. And you let the other people take the risk on operating the deals until it becomes really good for that to happen again.
On that note about flips being over budget and not on time, Eric, you mentioned to me on the deal that we were kind of looking at together, the fines for late fees basically was under what you thought it should be. What's the process you guys use to go and calculate what that fee should be at bare minimum for late fees, and also what strategies do you employ when the lender is hitting into those fees and it's not looking good?
Yeah, well, I'll just answer the previous question briefly too, in that whenever something goes wrong, in the sense that it didn't go catastrophically wrong, but it's taken a few weeks, maybe a month or so longer than expected, if you're the borrower, if you're doing the flip, then that means less money. That means you're paying more on the loans. That means more operation hassle. That means you're doing more and more work for less and less money. So it's a losing game. Whereas if you're lending and you've done the loan properly, when it gets late by a little bit, then you're making more money, right? And I would say the absolute bare minimum is to have a late fee that's at the same rate, which sounds kind of crazy, but I've seen people do it differently. You know, have a late fee that's the same rate of what they're already borrowing at. So if their, you know, if their monthly payment is $3,000, that's about $100 a day, right? So the bare minimum would be that. I've seen loans that are $6,000 a month and people put a $100 a day late fee on there. That just doesn't make sense because you're rewarding them for being late now. Now they're paying less for the daily late fee than what they were paying for the original loan anyways. So I would say as a starting point, at least 50% more, right? So if their daily rate on the regular loan would have been $100 a day, then at least 150, if not maybe double, so $200. And what Logan has said that I've taken to heart as well is that the late fee needs to be painful, needs to hurt. And the borrowers need to think about it and say, you know, if I'm late on this loan, this is really going to hit me in my checkbook hard. So I need to make sure that I can be Johnny on the spot, get this rehab going, get this sale going, be realistic about my price point and not let this delay. Because if you're too soft on it, then the borrowers are going to take advantage of that and just delay week after week.
Yeah, we've seen this happen several times, and we've, full disclosure, like we messed this up at the beginning. Like we were just kind of naive. Again, like I have never been late on a payment for a loan in all the years that I've borrowed money. I've always given myself ample time, and I've never paid back a lender late. So I kind of went into it that same mentality and kind of, you know, that everyone's going to be on time. And quickly you find out everyone's not going to be on time, right? And so we just kind of pulled late fees out of the air at the beginning, and we learned really quickly, like, oh, this is not wise to let them borrow the money, like Eric said, at a lower rate. So yeah, we want the late fees to be more than the loan rate so that it is painful. And a lot of, you kind of borrow this play from some of the hard money lenders, is they just charge a flat fee, right? It's not a daily late fee. Like if you want a month extension, is what they do is like, hey, it's going to be X amount of dollars for that month extension, and that money's due. You have to buy the extension, right? So we're a little bit, again, a little different. We're private money. We work with the borrowers. We're having conversations with them. We're going to modify sometimes, even if we're getting outside of that late fee realm, we're going to modify the loan or modify the late fee terms. If they're responding and they're, you know, and they're communicating with us, we'll modify that, but it's still going to be painful for them, but we'll work with them to get the loan paid back. Cause at the end of the day, foreclosing is the last resort, worst case option. And what we have found is when the borrowers are communicating at a high level and everything is, you know, kind of coming to an end, you know, a couple days behind, it really bolsters the returns of the deals to have those high late fees in there.
So just to once again clarify, I want to make sure that everybody gets this. When you're calculating a late fee, let's say you're borrowing they're borrowing $100,000, and they're going to pay you back $130,000. You're going to take the $30,000 divided by the length of time that loan is in their hands, and get your daily rate. And your daily rate needs to be at least 50% more, if not double.
Yep.
Yeah. Bare minimum at the rate that you're already loaning the money at, right?
Got it. Yeah.
Yes. So for that example, let's say that it was a 4-month loan. And usually we write it in days, by the way, not months. So if it's a 60-day loan and July and August both have 31 days, then it's, you know, it's not the same calendar day each month. But anyways, like a 4-month loan, call that 120 days. Then if you loan them $30,000, if my math isn't off, I think that's $250 a day, right? Is what the normal amount is. So if they're giving you $250 a day normal, then you better be charging $350, $400 as a late fee on that.
What advice do you have for aspiring private money lenders to avoid some common pitfalls? I know we've talked about a lot of great options, but what are some last pieces of advice you would give to them to avoid these pitfalls? I'll give you, for instance, I just talked with a private money lender who wired money over and has had very little communication since then with the person drafting the documents. Hasn't signed any documents. So it seemed like maybe that's a situation where there was a little bit of excitement about getting into a deal quickly and not a lot of, I'm in control of this deal. I'm bringing the money to the deal, right? So I have the most skin in the game. That's the philosophy I would have. So I'm in charge of this deal, paperwork wise.
Yeah, there's never wire until everything is signed. You know, there are some cases where there's a neutral third party, for example, like because people have day jobs and they want to wire to title earlier just to make sure it's not waiting on them. They could wire to a neutral third party title that they can vet and trust. And then a day before the loan's going to close, they wire it, but they have an email, the title that says, and they maybe do a phone call too, that says, hey, do not release these funds to the borrower, right? I'm sending this to be at title right now, but don't release it. Only release it after I give you the okay and after I've seen that all of the documents are signed and done properly. But you know that's an exception. But usually, I would say to everyone, just don't wire any money at all until all the documents have been properly signed, the lien has been recorded and good to go. I've made that mistake on one of my first loans where they said, okay, well, you know, we're gonna sign the paperwork now, but we're gonna record it in a few days. You know, I think they promised it'd be recorded next day. It took a week to get everything properly filed, and I was on them all the time about that. So I'm fortunate that one closed properly, and then I got the money back on it. But it's one of those things where if I had to redo that one, I wouldn't have done that. I would have said, nope, everything has to be signed, recorded, filed. Everything has to be completely done and ready to go before I wire the money. And that's where you'll want to work with a transaction coordinator or an attorney or somebody that is working just for you. That's an important one too. A lot of the borrowers will say, oh, well, I have an attorney. I have a transaction coordinator. I have my people, but they're biased because they're working for that borrower. You need to find somebody that's just representing you and just watching out for your back, who's experienced on these deals, and they can look it out and see if it passes the sniff test, and they can verify that all the documents are done properly. And then once they give you the okay, and you also look it over yourself and say, okay, well, this seems right. You know, like I've got this third party or this person that's just, you know, working for me. They've approved it. They've seen the documents. I've seen the documents. Now I'll wire. You know, you'll sleep a lot better at night if you do that versus, especially if you're new, you're just like, okay, well, this sounds kind of right. Here's my money.
Yeah.
For sure. You absolutely never send money to anyone directly. And never send the money unless you've seen everything. And just to go along with like the mentality of, you know, what you're speaking to, Justin, like I call it always be the buyer, right? And whatever situation you're in, whether you're negotiating a deal, whether you're loaning money on a deal, whether you're the person that's borrowing the money, it's like, I always want to be in the position of being the buyer. What does that mean? That means that I have options, right? And a lot of times in these deals, the borrowers will make you feel pressure because of lack of preparation on their part. And so it's really hard in the moment, but you just have to sometimes say no and challenge the deadlines that they're giving you. Hey, we need to have this closed by Friday. Okay. One of the questions I ask is, what happens if it's not closed by Friday? Right. I don't just take it that Friday is like set in stone because I know better. It's not set in stone. What they're saying is, I want you to cut some corners so I don't have to have a hard conversation with the seller. Right? I'm about to not be able to perform. So I need you to hurry up and do this and rush through this. And like, Eric can tell you, like, I will just say no. Like, hey, I'm like, hey, if that's the parameters, the answer is no. Right? Like, we're not going to do the deal. So we always take the position of we're the buyers. There's always another loan. There's always another great deal. Like, they literally, thousands of transactions are happening every day, and they have for the last 100 years in America. There's always another deal. So I take the posture of I'm going to be the buyer, and I'm going to choose where my money goes. And like, I'm going to try to talk myself out of a deal. And if I can't, that I know that it's a good one, right? So that's kind of the mentality that you hit it right on the head. It's like, you're in control. Like, they are facilitating the transaction, but at the end of the day, it's your money. You be the buyer, and you decide where the money goes and when it goes.
And always the PML selects their personal choice for transaction coordinator. It shouldn't be selected by anybody, not even a connector. It should be not selected by somebody you know, somebody you vetted, you want them to do your deal.
100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
Real quick, last question about private money, or gap loans. I've heard of this structure, and I just want to see if this is something you guys also do. With hard money, obviously, they don't release all the funds at once. They go and give you funds released on a payment schedule. Mm-hmm. An inspection completed. When you guys are doing gap funding, is that also something that you do, and how do you structure that typically?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we do. One of the most typical ones, if it's a small loan, let's say they need $40,000 for rehab. Well, you know, let's see, okay, what do you actually need the $40,000 for? Send us pictures, send us a detailed scope of work. So maybe we'll see the scope of work in the pictures, and okay, there's a kitchen counter, and there's a bathroom, and there's whatever else that needs to be done there. Then we'll say, okay, well, we'll do this in two draws. So we'll do 20,000, and then we want to see progress. We want to see that, you know, half of this scope of work or whatever adds up to 20,000 is done. Then once that's done, we'll give them the next 20,000 for them to complete the rest of it. It doesn't make any sense to put the 40,000 all at once. And honestly, like, from some of my own flips and hard money loans that I've done, and from some that I've loaned on, you have a better return on your money that way as well. Because if you give the 40,000 all at front, then that's all of your money that's out the whole time, not giving you an extra return. Versus what's actually pretty crazy is that you put out the 20,000, and if there's delays in construction or the borrower is just struggling or whatever, there can actually be a pretty long time where you only have half that money out. And then later, even sometimes close to the end of the rehab, they're ready to do that last draw for the 20,000. So your actual return on your money out is a lot higher, and it's more secure that way, because they have to show that they've made progress before you give it all to them.
Do you guys typically hire an inspector local to go in and look at that property to make sure that progress is being made?
No, we usually have the borrower do that. We usually have them send us videos and pictures of the property. And that's usually sufficient for what we're doing. We're just looking not at the minor details, just the major stuff. I was also going to say is, like, it depends on the borrower too. There are situations where there's borrowers that we have pre-existing relationships with that we know, that we trust, that we'll fund all of that money at closing for them, because we already have a relationship with them. They have a track record. So it just depends on the situation. If we already have like a history with this person, for example, I have one going on right now with one of my very close friends that I've been friends with for years, and he's like incredibly trustworthy and he's a great person. It's like, I'm okay releasing the funds at closing because I know he's going to be responsible with them. Whereas a lot of times we get deals from connectors or people that we don't know that we're just forming relationships with. And those people were going to be much more hesitant to release all the funds to them because, again, they have more to prove because we don't have that standing relationship.
Last question. Who do you guys want to connect with most? Obviously, you want to connect with borrowers. Are there other folks that you want to be connected with in what you're doing?
Well, I think there's, like, for these creative short-term PML, bridge loans, gap loans, there's kind of two sides of the coin, right? There's the people who need the deal, and then there's the people who fund the deal with us. So we're constantly getting more and more of both and growing the system, and it's a very good and exciting thing. So I want to connect with people who maybe want to invest some of their money. They're tired of it sitting in the bank account, but they don't want to go flip a house themselves. They don't want all the hassle of this, but they want to put some money to work and get a good return that's well secured, right? So we want to connect with those type of people, but we also want to connect with anyone and everyone, a borrower who's looking for the deals themselves, maybe a connector, maybe it's also a loan officer or a broker who has clients come up to him saying, hey, I need a loan that can close in 2 weeks, in 1 week, can you do it for me? And the loan officer says, hey, no, I actually can't because my underwriting process is going to take longer, but I've got Congregation Capital, Logan and Eric that do private money. They could probably close you much faster than I could and give you a temporary bridge loan. So it's basically anyone and everyone who would have to do with this, you know, somebody who wants to invest their money and put it to work with flexible, good short-term returns, or somebody who needs that kind of funding to help get their deal done.
Yeah, and I'll just add a little bit of different color to that of like also people that are doing what you're doing, Justin. If people that are going to watch this or are going to listen to it somewhere that have a podcast or have a platform, we found that there's a really big need and a really big gap of information in this space. So like, we want to be connected with the people that have an audience that want to share, because we just want to teach people what's worked for us, and maybe it can work for them, or maybe they want to partner with us. Either way is a win, but we just want to help, you know, teach more people this process and this business because we think it's a super opportunity.
Awesome. What's the best way for people to connect with you?
That is a great question. We are still working on getting the full marketing and branding for our Congregation Capital up, but Logan and I are both active, phone, email, social media. In the notes, I guess you could post the info and we can have that available for people who want to reach out to us.
Facebook is the easiest place to message me. I always have that available, that chat available. So Facebook Messenger is the easiest place to contact me for sure. But aside from my cell phone, but Facebook Messenger.
Awesome. Sounds good. Cool. Well, I'll get that info from you guys and we'll put it in the description down below in the video. Thank you guys so much for coming and sharing your wealth of knowledge. I look forward to continuing to keep in contact with you guys as I continue my journey into private money lending as well. Hopefully you all were able to learn something, and hopefully this connected with the ears of somebody who is getting ready to maybe get into private money lending and save you from some pitfalls as well, and make you the opportunity to be able to make a boatload of money. Thank you guys for joining me. And until next time, you've been listening to Nursing Real Wealth.